the archaeologist recognizing here? Or do you want them to actually?
You can recognize it.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for attending the April 20th, 2021 Anesthesia and Sedation Committee meeting. So, again, thank you for being here. I guess I can turn it over to staff and roll call, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. I'll do that, and we can recognize them just from the screen, or you can have them respond, whatever you prefer. And for everybody, just while she's pulling the list up, a reminder, whether you're joining us virtually by phone or in person, please tell us your name as you begin to speak. That really helps for the minutes and for us to know who said what when.
Okay, I'm going to do roll call. Goodman?
Present.
The guy?
Present.
Bingstock is absent. Blazik?
Present.
Brady? He's absent.
He'll be here.
He is delayed. He's on the way.
Oh. Brownstein? Christensen?
Here. Hero. Christensen, present.
Thank you. German?
German's here, and I'd like Christensen to tell us what El Snowflake means. Is that your nickname we can call you?
That's what the kids call me.
But he's in Russia.
Loud?
Present.
Snail?
Here.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to give staff another moment to help us with our echo.
Maybe they can turn these off.
Okay, those aren't on.
Oh, they're not? Okay.
Do we still have an echo?
Oh,
Dr. German, would you speak for a moment so we can see what happened?
Yeah, this is Dr. German.
Thank you. Yeah, we do not have an echo anymore.
Sorry about
that. No, good work on you.
Oh,
yeah.
Awesome, thank you.
Well done.
All right, so... like any open meeting, we are going to do a call to the public. Do we have anyone signed in for the call to the public or present?
No.
No.
All
right.
So hearing none, seeing none, and knowing of none, we will proceed. Review, discussion, and possible action on committee meeting minutes from March 19th. I was the one committee member not present. So look for discussion and a motion to accept it.
I make a motion to accept the minutes from the March 19, 2021 meeting.
Thank you.
I'll second it. No.
Thank you. Discussion, any corrections, ideas?
They were excellent.
Oh.
Whoever did them, they were excellent.
That is true. They do a fine job. All right, so all in favor of accepting them?
Aye.
All opposed? All right, hearing none, and I'll abstain since I wasn't in attendance. All right, so moving on to item number four, current statute and rules regarding anesthesia and sedation. So we do have our additional expert help in our rules writer that helps the dental board here today. So hopefully that'll help us in today's discussion. So turn it over to the committee members of where are we on the statutes and rules, and what's the pleasure of the committee to proceed now?
I don't know any current. Yeah, I would defer to Dr. Hero. This is Blazik. I think what we elected to do probably two meetings ago would be to kind of table the general discussion of the statutes and rules and focus on more, deliberate issues. And I think these are some of the other things that we have here.
Yeah.
We have the adverse occurrence report, which we did pretty good last time on, getting that tightened up. Had a few things that we still wanted to discuss. We have the withdrawal of the SB 1372. That's on our agenda. And then ASDA's report or document, as well as the one Dr. Brady provided from the Mississippi, City of Mississippi, their document about rules and regulations.
Okay. So, yeah, what we'll do then is, as it applies to item number four, we'll engage that, because it sounds like some of those will end up applying. But since we don't have any new, let's talk about it in that section. We'll move on and go to number five of certified nurse anesthetist in the dental office in that discussion.
I was going to start on that one with where did the survey come from? Who generated that and who provided it for us?
I could answer this, but guys, just from what I read in the material sent over, it looks like it was generated from the executive director of the Louisiana State Board of Dentistry, just asking some questions, and he got 12 responses.
Mm-hmm. So did Ryan just, this is Blazik, did Ryan just add that to our document? Is that how it came forward?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, cool. I thought that was pretty interesting and timely, actually. So this is Blazik again. I guess with item five, then, do we want to dive in to the aspect of 1372? That's what this really talks about, and how it was tabled, and how we want as a committee to address that item, or should we go back to the adverse occurrences, which I would say we're not prepared to really do today, because not everybody's here, and we don't have the document that we wanted to review in order to complete the study.
Yeah, this is the guy. I'm not sure why this was on the agenda, but from what I read in it, just one piece that I found interesting is there's five states of the 12 that don't require a permit. Four of those five states are opt-out states, where they've opted out of physician supervision of CRNAs, just like we have in Arizona. The one state that isn't an opt-out state is Virginia, and that state has some more restrictions, even though there's no permit required in Virginia. The CRNA is only allowed to do an anesthetic depth of monitorization. The other states, there aren't such restrictions. But that's just one thing that I thought was interesting and worth mentioning. There's 19 states that have opted out of physician supervision of CRNAs, and the ones that responded to this survey, the four that there's no permit necessary, they're opt-out states.
So they continued with the ability to grant latitude.
Yeah, I'm not sure when the dental rules came in relation to, becoming an opt-out state.
Let's pause for one moment. It looks like we have a technical problem we need to address. Sorry. Okay. No, I know I'm cutting you off.
Sorry about
that. That's good, man.
No problem.
Can everyone hear us on the phone?
Dr. Germain, Dr. Snowflake.
I can hear you. This is German. I don't know if Snowflake can hear you or not, but...
Seth, can you hear us on the phone?
Loud and clear. This is Christensen.
Okay.
So Dr. Christensen can, Dr. Ken. But Seth did not respond to you.
No, he didn't.
He may be now, though.
I'm not on the phone. I'm on the video.
Okay. And Jessica, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Okay, perfect. Sorry. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So problem cleared, back to you.
I don't know when the dental rules happened versus when the opt-out happened in those states, but opt-out happens when you look at, statute for regulation of surgery practice, and when governors see that there isn't a need for supervision per the statute, that's when they authorize opt-out. So it could have been the dental board following those rules did it before the opt-out. Or I guess what I'm saying is it doesn't necessarily matter.
It isn't always.
It's just interesting that, that's what's going on.
And this is Blazik. And Aldi, I know you explained it last time, but just to help me, just point of clarification, What's the difference between that, the opt-out, I think that you're talking about, versus the Medicare thing that was going on early on in the pandemic, you know, a year or so ago? Or is that the same idea?
Yeah, it kind of falls in line. Opt-out comes from the governor's office when they look at the practice rights of the CRNA in the state. And if those practice rights show that a CRNA does not require supervision by a physician to practice, then that governor can choose to opt out, which is a CMS requirement, is what opt out.
So it allows for billing.
The opt out is primarily a billing item, but it's a reflection of what the laws are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like if the law says that a CRNA must be supervised by a physician, a governor can't trump the statute and say, okay, we're opting out. Mm-hmm. The governor can only opt out in a state that allows for independent CRNA practice.
I see. And this is Blazy again. And then how does that play in with CRNAs actually having the ability to get a DEA?
It's two different.
Is it two different things?
Yep. Yeah, DEA is regarding prescriptive authority.
Mm-hmm. But that's not traditionally, this place again, not traditionally part of your training that you come out. I mean, I think traditionally the CRNA didn't get DEAs, but now in Arizona, they do, right?
Your second part was correct. Arizona, we do. The first part is incorrect. We do have extensive pharmacology training.
Oh, yeah.
You come out of school with a DEA. And 49 states, CRNAs were coming out with a DEA, now all 50. Arizona, back in 2013, there was kind of an unintended consequence of some changes in the statute when they moved from rule to statute that took away our DEA right. Prior to 2013, CRNAs in Arizona could have DEA.
Oh, they did. Okay.
Yeah, we just restored that in 2013.
Yeah, I saw that was recent restoration in your thing. Yeah. Okay. And you guys did that legislatively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because taking it away in 2013 was a legislative process, so it had to be a legislative process. But.
I see. Okay. And I'd be interesting to know on this survey why they have so little participation.
Yeah, I'm surprised. They must not care.
Yeah, care. I mean, only 13 out of 50 states. 12, yeah. That's 12 then, yeah.
You're adding on the state that asked for it.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah, their data is not even on here. Yeah, no, I look at it.
Well, Ms. Goodman, they likely had a meeting similar to this one to go over it, and they already knew their own.
Yeah, this is Blazy again. Just as an aside, if someone didn't get a chance to look at this, I thought it was a pretty interesting document, especially the full survey, where some of the states went into some depth about, you know, what their statutes say and why they do that kind of thing.
Goodman, so we found it to be interesting, informative, intriguing. Do we need to use it for anything with our rules and our discussion of changes that are needed in the state of Arizona?
Well, I think that, this is Blazy, I think the survey piggybacks on to the issue that we have with SB 1372. And opportunities for CRNAs to practice in the state of Arizona on the same plane that dental anesthesiologists, oral surgeons, or anyone in the field of dentistry practices. So it piggybacks well, and hence I think that's why Ryan included it. And so the question to the committee, I think, is this something we want to tackle today and talk about it? And maybe this is the only thing we get to, but we do something, you know? And, you know, and we're only here till 5:30. Great. That would be good. I think that sounds like a good goal. That was the idea last time. So let's pick one. If this is where we start, let's start.
Okay. So use it as background comprehensive info.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
This is Christensen here. I don't want to put Dr. German on the spot, so to speak, but I was curious to see what you thought about the SB 1372 as a medical anesthesiologist and more specifically a pediatric trained. What were your thoughts as you reviewed that, or if you had a chance to? If not, we can circle back around, but I was curious.
Sure. So, and I spoke with Ali about this a little bit before, but, I think the idea was interesting. I think the concept was something that Ali was, I think, trying to accomplish when he initially came into the committee, as a CRNA representative, which was providing access to anesthesia and sedation to these patients. I did not necessarily agree with the approach that the society was taking, by bypassing the dental board and going right to the legislature. But I think the point is, in which Ali was talking about really initially, and I think continued throughout the committee meetings, is that, there were significant delays in obtaining access to permits that were preventing he and his group from providing necessary sedation services to patients. And so if in fact that is true, then I think that's something that we need to address. As far as pediatrics go, I have a whole lot of different opinions, obviously. But we can talk about those kind of as we delve into the bigger issues.
I'm glad you brought that up. This is Christensen again. Thanks, Dr. German. I guess we've heard about this delayed access to care, but I have not seen one documented case. And maybe Sherry can look into this, that, you know, what has been the timeline? How many dentists is this involved? I just heard of one event. It seemed surprising. I don't know. I can't even remember the timeline, but I haven't seen any specific. We keep talking about access to care and delayed care, but we have no documentation. We have no really proof of what's taken place or if this is even really going on. Maybe we can actually put something in writing or something in front of us that shows that this is an issue. If it's not, then I don't know if there's any use talking about it.
This is Snow. I can just give empirical information doing site visits and things for sedation. I have one right now for a 1302 permit that from the dentist side of things, he's saying since July, he's been waiting for this, and that's a 1302. So I think there are some individuals when they apply for a sedation permit because of various reasons that the process gets delayed. I'm not sure that it's unique to 1304. I think it's a combination of maybe not having enough evaluators that are willing, trying to combine multiple schedules, doctors that are getting the site visit, not being willing to be accommodating, and what I found to be a large portion of it, when the evaluators say, we can do this day, and they say, well, I can't do those days. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a bunch of different reasons, but I don't, just personally, I've seen it in the 1302 realm. That's where I do my site visit. I don't know that it's unique to 1304. I think it's a generalized issue.
Thanks, Dr. Snow. I think the next question is then, if there have been some issues, what is the timeline that's reasonable for everybody? I mean, maybe that's something we need to start with. And then if somebody's, has an issue with not doing it within 2 months or 3 months, then maybe that's an issue. But do we have an exact time frame, Sherry, on that? And maybe you can lead us through this.
Maybe try muting your screen.
Yeah.
I am muted. Let me try it this way. Okay. Sorry.
We're happy to hear you twice,
for record. Hello. I think where you're looking at the extended amount of time is once an application is complete. Susie sends them out a notice letting them know they're complete, and it's up to them to work out a schedule with an evaluator. And as we tell them that the evaluators are volunteers, so you have to work with their schedule. So I think a lot of times that is what happens. Now, we have timelines, I don't have to look, that once an application is complete, the timeline stops for us. And it's just the fact of getting it scheduled between the applicant and the evaluator. And there's many, many times that they can't get on the same schedule. I would be interested in knowing about the 1302
and the one from July, and then I can personally look into that.
Yeah, this is Goodman. Thank you. Putting more rules and more defined timelines won't control volunteer, and it won't control those that are being evaluated. What we're talking about is the general idea of access to care, and if we're thinking 12 states answering a survey for one other state is a low number, try all of the different potential sites and figuring out getting usable data from Arizona. I think that is not going to be how we figure out if access to care currently is compromised or if it will be. Sadly, it will be one-off stories, and because, you know, by the time we publish the survey, the facts are going to be changed. So that'd be my take, is as much as data is important and interesting, it's not going to be helpful at this point. That's world according to Kristen on Tuesday.
This is German. Just a quick question. The ASDA guidelines that were sent with our packet talk about a defined guideline. I can't remember what it was, 60 days, I think, and then, you know, for a temporary permit to then obtain a permanent permit within 12 months or some other defined period of time. What kind of volume, Sherry, are we talking about? How many permit applications are you guys seeing in any given year? I mean, is this exorbitant amount of permits? And if so, have you considered maybe not going through a volunteer system, but maybe even a paid system or other incentive type system?
Prior to Christina and Ryan coming, it was, even though they still volunteer their time, they can now be paid when they do those for each evaluation that they do. Now, as far as the amount that there are, I would have to refer to Susie, being that she is the one that receives the application when they come in. Susie, can you give them an idea how many amounts that we have? I would be able to run a report if you want to give me a little few minutes.
This is Hero, just a point of clarification. Are we talking about new permits being issued, not renewals, or both?
I'd go with both because it gives you
a I would define it. But I would probably define it.
And it's true because initials require two evaluators, and re-evals require one, which scheduling-wise makes a big difference.
And on a re-eval, they already have the permit. They're able to continue to use it. Whereas the
unless it expires.
Sure, but at least they've got that time frame saved. I think, though, that there would be more accommodation made for somebody who had an expiring permit come up than the initial one just sitting in the wings.
Well, on a renewal, they are to have their evaluation scheduled by October 10th, I want to say?
Yes, October 10th.
By October 10th for their renewal. It says that in rule. So if they go past the time and it isn't complete, then they do have to start over the process. If they don't get everything into us in the timeline, in what the timeline says, because we already have timelines that we have to abide by. But then again, I think what we're talking about as far as is once they are complete is getting the evaluators with the applicant in order to have the evaluations done. I think that's what we're talking about, and I don't know if there's any way around it because you're still working on two or three people's different schedules. And on initial evaluation, you're required to have two evaluators. Where on a renewal, you only required one evaluator.
This is
German. Is there any incentive for the evaluator to get that evaluation done sooner than later?
From my standpoint, there's no incentive for me as the evaluator other than I could get $50 to do the evaluation and some CD for it.
Right.
But that doesn't matter. I still get that whether I do it within the next 2 weeks or 4 months.
Correct.
There is some disincentive too. Now you've got another office that can offer sedation.
True. If I was looking at it that way, I would hope the evaluators don't choose the evaluator if they're going to take that stance. But that is a conflict of interest for sure.
Yeah, $50 probably isn't moving the needle in the life of the evaluator, but possibly, I don't know how many minutes it takes, but, all right.
That's a great lunch.
Oh, go ahead.
Goodman, it's a good lunch. $50, it's a good lunch.
Oh. Better than I, yeah, I mean, with inflation soon, Chipotle will be that. Put that on the record. But yeah, go ahead.
This is Blazek, and I may be incorrect in this, but what I thought had happened a few years back was they restricted the evaluators to only evaluate permits equivalent to their level of permit. And I think that that squeezed the pool of evaluators. Now, I may be wrong on that, but is that correct? That so if it's a 1301 permit, only a 1301 can evaluate them?
No.
It's not.
If it's a, well, if it's a 1301, only a 1301 could.
But not.
But in the case like a 1303, it has to be on that level or at a higher level.
Or higher.
But if they're going for a 1303, sometimes they don't want a 1301 evaluating them because they're afraid that the bar will be too high.
Well, let's say we take that off the table. That opens the evaluators.
But I mean, I'm gonna stick up for my evaluators. I mean, I call them and they are really good about trying to schedule, about getting stuff. They'll do it Saturdays, they'll do it after hours, they'll do it early. So that's not an issue. In 2015, the thing was brought up about the 1304, and there was one that was on the table for a long time. And so we did a report at that time and gave it to, in a packet. We gave it to you guys. And now it's coming up that, well, we don't know what the real numbers are, but the average is 73 days. And a lot of them are below the average.
And if I can but interject, from the beginning of receiving the application to the date that you have issued their permit to them.
Yes.
So total number of days.
Right.
And for all.
And then of course they want it yesterday. A lot of the time, you know, they'll say, well, I've got somebody scheduled on Tuesday. Don't schedule till you have a permit. And so.
Excellent job, Sherry. I think that's great. I think something within 3 months is totally, totally appropriate. If anybody's applied for hospital privileges, they know it takes some time. And I think it's important that we put a timeline on that. I mean, that we'd like to have it done within 90 days or something along those lines. I've been an evaluator and I actually enjoy doing it. I've wondered if we need to. I know you kind of try to break this up geographically, correct, Sherry? But I wonder if we had some geographic, if we had everything kind of broken up geographically and worked at trying to get a certain number of evaluators in each geographic area, and maybe that would allow a little bit more fluidity and maybe accountability for getting people taken care of. That's just a thought I had.
This is Snell. From what I've seen as well, speaking to your point, when I talk to many applicants, they say they've been waiting since June, July. But then when I say, do you have that packet that talks about what instruments you're supposed, you know, what medical stuff you're supposed to have, what emergency drugs you're supposed to have, like, I didn't get any packet. I'm like, well, obviously you haven't really even started the process. So they think it's taking a long time and it's somebody else's fault, when in reality, they haven't done what they're supposed to do yet. Mm-hmm. I've witnessed that a handful of times from applicants.
Is it possible, Sherry, to get a list of the evaluators?
Sure.
That we have in the state? And I ask that question because I think with the connections that we have, we can ask other people to become evaluators. It's not really that hard, and we can help educate them, you know, how to become better evaluators and then make that process. And whether it's a 1304 or it's an 01 or an 02, you know, it shouldn't take long. I know Eddie and I have talked about this. When I get an application, I mean, within a week or 10 days, I'm doing the evaluation. Just make it happen. Not that hard to do. You know. So.
So this is Susie, board staff. I do occasionally, like, especially if someone retires or someone moves, I will send out a letter to the doctors that are in that area with that level of permit. And then there's, they have to have had the permit
5 years
for,
I think three, right?
Yeah, I think it's 3 years. They have to have had the permit for 3 years. So sometimes we get some newbies who are just really excited about getting that on their, mm-hmm. you know, that little tag on there that they're an evaluator.
but we can't accept anybody under 3 years. And so, but I do send stuff out, you know, like I just recently sent out to the 1303s in Mesa, you know, saying, hey, you know, this is important, this is what we need, and this is how you could, you know, submit your resume or CV in order to become an evaluator. And so I do make effort in that area when I see that there's a slacking. And of course, some of the other ones like Cave Creek and St. John's and stuff like that is a little harder to get evaluators to go up there. But but we work pretty hard at getting the evaluation done.
Well, this is Blazing again. I think that, you know, if you employ some of us, we could try to help you. You know, like we have an Arizona Society meeting on Thursday, and I could certainly promote that and say, hey, look, the board needs more evaluators. Even to the point of, you know, where we'll take somebody who has, you know, 3 years of experience and say, you're going to be an evaluator.
Can I just interrupt and ask a question? What agenda item is this?
5. It goes along with 5, I guess.
Does it?
Yeah, because we're talking about, this is Blazing again, I feel we're addressing the idea about how do we make the permitting process easier, because one of the chief complaints from the CRNA point of view and related to the bill SB 1372 is that doctors can't get permits and then therefore they can't get in the office to do anesthesia.
That may be a little bit of a stretch for the way this is worded.
Well, this is Blazing. Unfortunately, I think that addressing SB 1372 should be on the agenda, and I think this was Ryan's way of putting it on there. Now, Ryan's not here, so it's hard for us to comment about it, but well, we certainly know that's an agenda item.
So, yeah, this is the guy. 1372 doesn't exist anymore.
No, it doesn't.
So I don't know why we're talking about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
In respect to the fact that we have legal counsel here, I would strongly recommend we move on in the discussion and honor our legal counsel's very subtle direction, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So anything else from the survey, I think on 5, or do we move on to 6 at this point?
This is Christensen. I just want to tell Sherry, you're doing a great job, and however we can help you, we'll be willing to do so. And we have, I think with a little marketing, we can help facilitate a lot of these issues and get a lot of more people involved. So thank you, Sherry.
You're welcome. And Susie and I, we will brainstorm and come back with something also. And we appreciate that you could give the information for us.
All right. This is Harold. Before we move on, maybe the discussion elaborated too much in an area that's not on this agenda item, but to Dr. Blazik's original point, the purpose of the committee was formed to review the current rules and statutes. The 1304 permit is a big part of that.
Yeah.
And I think we've got a discussion going and an opportunity right now to discuss that. This agenda item does reflect that. Committee to review and discuss AACR 411-1304. Let's talk about the 1304 permit. And if we're done talking about it, great, let's move on. But I hate to.
Please. Yeah, go ahead.
I'd be curious, Ali, I feel like a lot of people are saying the CRNA, and I'd like to get your input on it. Is the issue with the 1304 that it is take too much time, or do you feel like there's other issues with that? That I would like, if there's a problem, I'd like to try to fix the problem. And if we find out that this problem is perceived, but it's not really there, then that's one thing. But if there's multiple issues and it needs to be restructured for multiple reasons, I would like to know that from your standpoint, because I think of all of us, you're the one that deals with the 1304 the most.
Yeah, sure. This is the guy. So the time is definitely the biggest concern. You know, as Dr. Christensen mentioned, you like to see the data. There's no reporting system for dentists to write in and say it's taking too long. There's no reporting system for dentists that call a CRNA or a physician anesthesiologist and say, hey, I've got a case next week that I need anesthesia for. Can you come to my CPR, the permit, no, we can't come in, where the dentist anesthesiologist can go right in. That's a big part of the problem, that a physician anesthesiologist and a CRNA were all trained in just anesthesia, not like oral surgeons do anesthesia and oral surgery. The dentist anesthesiologist can go right in, and we can't. There's a few different reasons why that's troublesome. You know, back in September, I presented some language that we all agreed to that I think is a big step in the right direction of solving it. There's also that article from the ASDA that I think has some nice language in there talking about, as Dr. German mentioned, that said, it said in their section regarding having a physician anesthesiologist or CRNA in CRNAs, or states where CRNAs are practically independent, that it's a 6-week expected turnaround time from the board, and then a 12-month provisional period that they can have those services until they get an inspection. I thought that was actually pretty nice language that we could potentially adopt. What I had suggested we agreed to back in September was basically that physician anesthesiologists, the CRAs that want to go into dental offices and provide those services, get a certification from the board. And they come to the board and they get the certification and they attest that they're always going to have the appropriate equipment and everything else. And that then the dentist who wants those services applies for the permit, says, I'm always going to use one of the providers on your list, the certified people. And I think that's a pretty reasonable solution that this committee did agree to have move forward to the board. So
yeah, I have a question for you, Mr. Goodman. What places in Arizona are you not allowed to sedate? Because your ability through your licensing, through your board, you're allowed to sedate where?
Per statute?
Yeah.
Anywhere
in the state,
any
right?
Medical facility, an ambulance, a dental office.
RV converted to a medical facility. I mean, like...
If it got licensed.
Any licensed medical facility except dental office.
We are statutorily allowed in dental offices.
But then the rules of dentistry make it so you can't.
Right. Well,
what are the exceptions to what the state already says you're allowed to do? Dentistry, and there are others that I'm trying to gain that.
Well, this is lazy. So there is some restriction. You have to be credentialed.
Yes.
So you can't go to a hospital and then do anesthesia unless you're credentialed. You can't go to an ambulatory surgery center unless you're credentialed. You can't go to a converted motorhome unless, like you said, unless it's been
licensed. Accurate.
Yeah.
I can administer anesthesia in a physician's office without credentialing.
Okay. Yeah.
A physician's office.
There's no requirement for credentialing in a medical office.
And you can, and to clarify, Goodman, you can do it in a physician's office without the physician immediately present.
And the credentialing is
correct.
Not
is
a state law.
Yeah.
The credentialing is a facility requirement.
Yeah.
This is Harold. To what level of sedation can you do in an unlicensed physician's office?
So a physician's office would need, for general anesthesia, they have to get certified by the Department of Health.
Correct.
But there's still no credentialing. So if we're talking about credentialing, there's no credentialing. It's just the certification of the office.
Okay, of the facility, quote facility.
Right, but in relation, right, let's say there's a plastic surgeon's office that wants to do general anesthesia. So if he gets certified through the Department of Health Services, that office gets certified, right?
Right.
So if any anesthesia provider wants to go into that certified office and give general anesthesia, any anesthesia provider can go in. But what we have right now in dentistry is that a general dentist or even a specialist that does not hold a permit, they can have a dentist anesthesiologist come in right now who has the permit, but anesthesia provider can go in.
But it's not reverse. Like, I can do sedation in the dental office, and I can't go to that certificate, that medical plastic surgeon's office and do sedation for them.
Why not?
The medical won't allow me to.
The dental board won't allow you to?
No, the medical won't allow me to.
I don't think that's... Is that accurate? I don't think that's accurate.
I think there's just not, you're not asked to. I think,
interesting.
Yeah, and
you could go to a hospital.
Without getting into fee schedule,
right,
because you may not want to, you're probably going to get reimbursed less. So,
right.
Dentistry is better at that.
So you think a dental provider, anesthesia provider could go into a...
I don't think there's anything regulatory that would prohibit you from doing that.
If you have
and the only thing, and there's nothing regulatorily prohibiting you from doing it at a hospital. Maybe that hospital's own facility credentials. There's certainly hospitals that only allow physician anesthesiologists to provide anesthesia, and I can't go there.
What,
you know, so every I mean, it's local control, right? That's local control is a good thing. Overburden of the government is not such a good thing. At least that's my personal opinion.
Mr. Charlie, what was the summarization of the language you had proposed?
So the summarization was basically that a office applies for a 1304 permit. I created some confusion because I used some language from Dr. Snell's class 1234 instead of, and then that created confusion. I think it was the group. But basically, what it was that a dentist applies for the permit, and they can get the permit and have an inspection, and then bring in whoever they want. In lieu of the inspection, they get the permit, and they can bring in one someone who's certified by a non-dentist who's certified by a dental board to provide anesthesia services.
What this is Blazing. Ollie, do you have any personal experience with the Department of Health certifying an office?
I've not with an office with ambulatory surgery. I've been in offices that are certified, but I wasn't part of the process with that.
I'm curious what that's about.
Yeah, and having had anesthesia in our office for the medical practice I run, my understanding of it is you can be a licensed facility based on your ownership, or you can have an exception to being a licensed facility if it's basically physician owned and operated. So some of the facilities that allow CRNAs probably aren't licensed by the state at all. They're just acting under the physician license.
Correct. Yep. But just Dr. Hero's question, those offices that aren't licensed by the state, they're only going to moderate.
Right. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's not on my plan. I mean, there's a urology group upstairs, and they're regularly using CRNAs and NMDs, and it's a moderate sedation, whereas the surgery centers in our building obviously have the higher credentials, higher certification.
What level of sedation are we talking about for dentistry?
I think so it's a urology office.
No, but dentistry, we're talking moderate.
I think Ali would like to general.
In my practice, I do mostly moderate sedation, there's a couple that
will work with,
or
doing
bigger cases, but you generally
have to try them too.
Right.
Okay. I think that, this is Blazing, I think one of the biggest issues that the people in dentistry have, I think, I'll speak, for kind of the general populace that I represent, is that we feel the majority of the dental offices are not qualified or would not pass an inspection to have general anesthetic in the office. And we feel that not only for CRNA people to provide it, but I personally feel it for the mobile anesthesia permit, which a lot of our colleagues have and some of my oral surgeon friends have. And I think it puts a heavy onus on the person with the mobile permit to vouch for every office they go into. And so that is the one of the bigger overlying issues, I would say, for, I believe, safe delivery of anesthesia in the state of Arizona is how do we ensure that office is set up properly? And I agree. You said last time, Dr. Snell, you come in with your stuff and you make that office acceptable. And we had a discussion about equipment not being checked, and that is up to the anesthesia provider. How many checks and balances can we have? But I feel when you force an office to have some type of an evaluation, we are saying as a committee and as a dental board, we are expecting this level of care to be provided in this office, and we're not leaving it open to interpretation.
So what's the solution to those with the mobile permits to be general anesthesia?
Well, I think that all those offices should get 1304 permits. That's my opinion, but I know people don't agree with it. People think it's too cumbersome, it's going to be too difficult, but that is exactly what our medical colleagues do through the Department of Health.
For general anesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
So would you think if it's moderate sedation, there shouldn't need to be a permit required?
No, I think there should be. I think they all should have.
I just don't think when we walk through all those cases of poor outcomes, mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything that lends itself to say a mobile provider is
more dangerous to the general public.
No.
So because of that, I just don't see why throw more rules and regulations and make it more cumbersome if there's nothing there to support that up to this point. If something were to come about, then maybe you address it and say, okay, why is this happening? Well, far and away, it's mobile providers that are causing harm. I just don't see that, the correlation at all.
So,
and that's held true in multiple states, not just...
Well, I think that brings up a good point, right? We want data. Well, we don't like that data, so forget that data. But well, we don't have the data we're looking for. We need that data. I mean,
I think the data is very important, and it can change.
No, I agree. It's important. I just, some of that, those are going to be rabbit holes that we'd be researching the rest of our lives.
Right.
I think, by the way, I was agreeing with you. The data that we have shows.
Right.
And why are we looking for some data that doesn't exist to go against the data?
That's why I think when Dr. Christensen was saying, I haven't seen any data for the timing of issuing permits, like you were saying, well, this office, they, you know, try to call me up and say, hey, can I get in there? Well, no, you need a permit. I just don't feel like there's an inability for them to get someone in their office that can do sedation. I think there's enough sedation providers from a reasonable scheduling standpoint to be able to do that. I could be totally wrong. I'm just looking at...
Yeah, I mean, not from what I've heard. There's no data, but right. You know, from what I heard, they say, oh, I call the potential anesthesiologist group when they're booked out for the next 4 months.
And I guess I don't live in the general anesthesia world, so that could be for general, that might... That can't
the way
that.
It is in rural areas.
Yeah.
This is Hiro. I'm sorry, Dr. To me, it's not an issue of, well, if a CRNA or a physician or a dental anesthesiologist, I'm probably more aligned with what Dr. Blazek brought up. And my concern is more in the average general dentist that's electing to bring in an anesthesia provider. We all went to dental school. I can tell you, and I've been in anesthesia my whole career, your exposure to any anesthesia, medical emergency related in dental school might as well be zero. You know, I mean, it's totally different in pediatric residency and oral surgery residency, but in dental school, we just don't get the exposure to it. So, and I've worked with just about every day of my career, either a CRNA, an MD, or a dental anesthesiologist. And I mean, you get, just like anything, you get those guys that are good and experienced, and those that aren't, doesn't matter what hat they're wearing. I'm not opposed to exploring the need for, if you're a dentist and you're going to be working on a sedated patient, you need to have some kind of permit. And whether you're working with a dental anesthesiologist, a CRNA, or an MD, I think it evens the playing field, and I think it provides a little level of safety that isn't currently there. I also don't know if we need the inspection, though. I mean, why not have a signed affidavit that ACLS has been taken, PALS, if that's the realm, a checklist of basic equipment and emergency supplies you have in the office. It takes a little bit of the onus off the board to try to find the inspector and go into the office. And it's making sure that at least there's a basic level of understanding of what the dentist is doing and not diverting, even though it is the responsibility of the anesthesia provider. At least we all know what it's like when you're working with somebody that, two people that understand what they're doing, or when you're on an island by yourself. So I don't know what thoughts are on that. But.
Well, Dr. Hare, I'm with you on the checklist for not reporting an adverse incident, but self-reporting that you're compliant with the expectation. Because I don't care if you fly Boeing for a living, if you don't do your checklist before you go up in a Cessna, you might die that day. And you just have to do your checklist or don't fly the plane. Same thing here is, you know, you can have the best CRNA coming in, the best dentist. If nobody's checked the oxygen, it's not going to matter really quickly.
Yeah, actually, so. I like your idea. I think it would give the board the ability to know where anesthesia is being done, which they don't know right now.
Right.
And if you're doing it without an inspection, it's just some paperwork that you're filling out to just have checks and balances to make sure that the office has the stuff. You send it in, the board approves. And you can have a grace period so that it doesn't blow up the whole
system. You also have accountability if there is an adverse event. Because then that dentist, that office has said, we are compliant with this list of supplies, equipment, and certifications.
So let me go back to why do we want to create new laws when the if our goal is to protect the common public, the current system, is it not protecting the current the common public?
Well, but it would be change one of the other permits to allow more freedom of...
And it would, and unintended consequences, it would restrict Dr. Brady and all those that go into PDX as a dental anesthesiologist that don't have to, those offices don't have to do that right now. And in my opinion, there's no reason why they should from a protect the safety of the public.
This is German. This is German. Just a couple of comments. If I remember correctly, of the cases we reviewed, I think 8 were dental anesthesiologists. There was 1 MD anesthesiologist of the 20 cases. I don't recall exactly what the office permits were, but assuming those were all mobile anesthesia providers, that's a significant amount of mobile providers on that list. I would assume that if we required offices to get the right permits, that there would be self-selection of offices that would ultimately become anesthesia centers, basically, right? That's where the majority of the deep and general anesthetics would occur. And I think there's a lot of benefit in that type of setting where it's a common occurrence. The teams are the same, and the list can go on and on and on. There's a lot of data and a lot of research to support having the same teams doing cases and repetitive cases as well. It's not going to change the need in the community for anesthesia. It would, however, change some of the traveling dynamics of those providers, obviously. But other than that, I don't see a huge poor incentive, you know, of mandating or requiring some sort of level of responsibility and accountability on those offices to get those permits.
This is Christensen, German. I agree with that. I think there should be some accountability of all receiving doctors and facilities.
This is Lau. I kind of agree with what I like your idea. My only suggestion is maybe require education.
Yes.
Affidavit, like, how to perform dentistry under general anesthesia office, patient selection, something like that. But like you said, at dental school, we don't know much.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it works with residents who used to do that, but I would think that that would help with the so-called paperwork of the 1304 and everything.
Right. Yeah.
Kind of a checklist and requirements and maybe some education. So people are aware that this anesthesia is doing everything and you don't have to worry about it.
Right.
Well, that would be my suggestion.
And Dr. Lau, to that, when the phone call's made, hey, can you come and do anesthesia, and the CRNA says, well, do you have your permit? If it's now a form they fill out that they attest that they have the equipment and their office is ready, then that becomes more access to care and more freedom.
Access
to care would be improved. It wouldn't be limited. It wouldn't, you know, it is filling out a form, but.
But I think, this is Loud again, I think the onus should go on how to select your anesthesia provider. And I think a lot of times people just don't do that.
And your patient.
And your patient history and all that stuff. Because the guy I use brings it all in. He's nasally intubated. He does general anesthesia. He's bringing in his office, probably like he does and you do. So, you know, I think that might be kind of I don't think it's a lot of paperwork.
I don't think.
But you really have to know what you're doing if you're going to bring somebody in your office to do anesthesia.
And you should.
And you're, you know, it's, and you just really should.
And I would think
it should be more than making a phone call.
Yeah. And I would, this is Harold, I would think the anesthesia providers would welcome that. You know what I mean? Yeah. You don't want to go into an office where they don't know anything and they're totally unprepared and the team is non-existent.
I don't think someone filling out a form takes the place of me talking to that provider and saying, am I comfortable working with you? That's why I don't think just doing rules to provide rules.
It doesn't, but it creates a situation where they know case selection, they're a little bit more aware of 80-year-old non-controlled diabetic in the office requiring full mouth rehabilitation with sleep apnea.
I'm
only talking about professionals. There's some people.
No, I agree, but why would an anesthesia provider go in and try to do that?
Well, it wouldn't mean that the anesthesia provider has to go.
I'm not. Well, but the stop should be the anesthesia provider saying, why in the world do I want to go in and do that case? That would just be.
But at the same time, the dental professional, the operating bench should have some responsibility.
This is here. I think the potential criticism, and I thought about this, and you mentioned it. So for the dental anesthesiologist that's going to go into the office, now the dentist is going to be required to get a permit. My initial thought is, I wonder how frequent that really is, though, because I think the dental anesthesiologists primarily are going into pediatric offices, oral surgeon offices, or general dental offices where they're already doing some level of sedation.
Mostly consistent clients.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know that the downside really exists of a delayed time frame for the anesthesia providers. What do you think, Dr. Blazek?
Well, yeah, so this is Blazek, and to Dr. Snell's earlier comment about, how it's not going to work because so many of these guys we're providing anesthesia for already, they don't have to have the permit, so why would they have to go through that process? I won't disagree with you, but I do think an elephant in the room is that we're trying to make it level. I think we're looking for a level playing field here. And if we're asking any dentist who wants a CRNA or an MD anesthesiologist who is just as well trained as any one of us in this room to come into the office and jump through extra hoops, that's not really fair to the dentist or to the anesthesia provider. Or the patient, right. But I like the verbiage that you use, Dr. Hero. I think that we're going down the right path here, that we're gonna put some onus on you to have some training and have the facility prepared and have your staff prepared and maybe a minimum number of cases on a yearly basis. That is moving towards a safe anesthetic as opposed to walking in doing the inspection. That alleviates this time delay. As a guy who was trying to tell you I wanted to provide some safety, and that's who I'm trying to represent from my aspect, I think that's a really good medium. That's a good middle of the road thing. And the guys who already, maybe there's a grace period. I think you said that, Mr. Begay, Ollie, I always hate this last name doctor thing. Yeah. Sorry, I just called me Randy.
So well.
That provides, give a 8 or 9 months, leeway. All we're asking a guy who's hiring you is to fill out the paperwork in the next 9 months and take an ACLS class, right? I mean, and have his office prepared for some basic emergencies. And I think it's a good middle of the road.
Yeah, this is Goodman. I'm looking at this. If they're prepared and they're already bringing someone in and the equipment's already going to be there, bring the form with you. Tell them, fill out this form and attest that we're prepared to move forward right now.
So then are you saying that if I...
I'm saying make it easy, yeah.
I bring all my own stuff in, does that qualify for them to fill it out? Because that stuff's always going to be there if they have me come in, because I'm always going to bring all that stuff that
you're... No, this way, that's why, because it may not always be you. Man, I love what you...
No, but they check it, and then if they check it and they want to attest to it, it's now in their office, in my opinion.
So if you think it's another level, right? Like, you could... One piece is that you could say in that document, part of it being, for the providers you bring in, verify if they're a physician anesthesiologist, they have XYZ credentials. Because for us, with my group, when we go to an office that doesn't require credentialing, our staff sends over a packet. This is their diploma, this is their board certification, everything that we would normally send to the facility. And then maybe another level is that you request that the office notify the dental board who the provider is that's coming in. So then the dental board not only knows what office is having anesthesia, but they know who's going in and doing the anesthesia. If it's the non-dentist.
Hello, guys. This is Jason Brady.
Okay, maybe not. Okay, take back that second part. Yeah, credentials. Check in the credentials.
Go ahead, Dr. Brady, and welcome. Glad to have you here.
Hey, I apologize to everyone. It was coincidentally the same time we're having our ADBA Board of Directors annual meeting. So I just got out of that, jumped onto this one. I did see that I was on the agenda to talk about some of the regulations, both in Model Edge, the ASDA is proposing are going through committees right now, and also with the Mississippi thing, I will ask if it's possible maybe that we can put that onto another agenda at another time, just so that I'm a little bit more prepared for it. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get to that point that I would like to be at for this meeting. Thank you for having me.
You're late and ahead.
All right. All right.
Yeah, I'm
very
like,
good. I guess there's one. Very good.
All right. But as so, could it be as simple as there being some attestation form in the rules that the dentist then can fill out and self-attest that, yes, we have a person with these credentials here doing it with this equipment ready and checked and prepared. And then if it's brought in by the mobile provider, it can meet that requirement. If it's hardwired into the office, great. But the individual dentist says, I'm personally attesting. Can't we have that level of accountability? They're the ones going to get sued and in front of the board either way.
There has to be some degree of professional accountability, right? You can't regulate every single piece. You know, you got to recognize
that
there's bad actors out there, right?
Right.
But the majority of, you know, dentists, nurses, and physicians are good people, good providers who want to do best by their patients and follow.
Yeah. So staff, Sherry, go ahead.
Within the practice themselves, when they apply for a permit, there is additional documentation. If they are having a mobile permit or they have additional locations, there are forms they have to fill out, and they are notarized stating that I have the exact same equipment in every office that I go to. And I don't know. I guess I need a clarification. What additional document are you wanting other than what is in that?
This is Hero. I think education, ACLS, or, and I think some of this is maybe a discussion for the next meeting, where I think at least we're starting to formulate a recommendation for a rule change that levels the playing field, to use Brandy's term, that I agree with. And raises the level of care for dental offices. I don't see much downside to this.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, well, here's what I would ask next, and this may not be necessary, but if we're going to require any dentist who's going to work on a sedated patient to have a permit, should there still exist a 1304 permit, or should there just be 1301 permits for DAs, oral surgeons, CRNAs, MDs? I don't know that that's a help or not. It's not a suggestion. I'm posing a question.
This is German. Dr. Arrow, I've been thinking, actually, I was writing a text to Randy because I got to hop on another meeting here. I agree with the direction that this discussion is going, and made me wonder about the exact same question you pose. If we did make it truly level, equal playing ground for the CRNAs, the MDs, the dental anesthesiologists in terms of mobile anesthesia, the MD, the CRNA would have to provide some sort of credentials or satisfy the board from a privileging standpoint. And then having that permit in the facility where they're sedating, also having a permit, there would be shared accountability, responsibility in sedating those patients.
So could it be that the application for that permit to bring in somebody, once you apply, you get your temporary? By the dentist applying today, saying I've met these requirements, their temporary starts, so we're no longer waiting for the site review. They're in jeopardy. If they fail the site review, they could lose that line of business, all that. And they have the personal risk because they've agreed that, yes, we are compliant as of today. I mean, that would make it so every dental office could fill the form out the day the rule's in place.
Well, I think Dr. Harrell said it would be temporary. It would, there wouldn't
so,
be,
You would say drop the site review.
Site review, so it would be.
Yeah, I mean, for eliminating the site review, I would defer to board staff as far as the turnaround time. But if we think the turnaround time was going to be longer than like 60 days, then yeah, I would look at it like an ASC granting temporary privileges until. But I think we're going to talk about 6 of 1 and a half dozen of another at that point.
And we could set the license fee for this at anything we want, so that wouldn't be a barrier.
Right.
Right, we could call it a $2 fee or whatever. I mean, I'm just thinking, if access to care provides what dentistry and Arizonans need, and if safety can at least be better predicted by having a checklist that we're agreeing every office is prepared with, seems like a good direction.
Isn't going back to what Susan?
This is Brady. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead, Dr. Brady.
I don't see a way to raise my hand on this form. Sorry, I'm just trying to look for that.
Okay.
I see it down here. It's down here on the right. I got it now. I won't be so disruptive next time. Sorry about that. But if you look at the Mississippi regulations, it does go into a lot of what you guys are talking about as far as having, and I'm kind of late to this discussion, but facility inspections or a permit and then having what to do with non-permanent providers. The difference, though, is that in Mississippi, and we have to have a good dialogue with the AANA, we worked for about a year to try to get them to do what you guys are proposing right now, and which is to permit all anesthesia providers, regardless if they're coming from dentistry, from medical, or from nursing. And the nursing board played nice for the first year after the regulation went into place. They had a big issue with permits and said that the dental board cannot permit our providers, even though historically they only could work to the level of a position of the dental provider. And so if we entertain this, we definitely need from Ali some kind of assurance that we're spending a lot of time and effort into this, that it's just not going to come and backfire on us where the nursing board is saying that you guys don't have jurisdiction. This is out of your jurisdictional boundary. And we already know that they've already tried to challenge this within the House and the Senate with their bill as of right now. So I'm a little bit cautiously optimistic on the conversation, but, it is something that we did venture down in Mississippi. I would encourage everyone to look at the Regulation 30 within Mississippi. I'm not sure. I guess I can ask Sherry if that one has been distributed to everyone. It has. Okay. So there might be a lot of common themes that we're talking about with
regards to that. Yeah, Dr. Brady, this is Goodman. I'm not suggesting that we would credential or certify any individual clinician who's not already licensed by the board. I'm suggesting that the individual location fills out the application, the form, and that dentist that's going to do the procedure certifies that the equipment and credentials are there to proceed. And they certify that anytime they are going to do this, they will always make sure this list is there, that they're going to check the list. Which would not be saying we're going to license or regulate CRNAs, because CRNAs are going to end up going in front of their own board if they have an adverse outcome. They don't need to go in front of two boards. So let dentists go to dentists and let nurses go to nurses, That's where I'm saying, let's don't actually try to regulate them. Just say they have to meet these requirements and be at this spot of training and knowledge to act in the dental office.
Okay, my only concern, and maybe this can be figured out, but my concern is if I'm not making any presumptions, but we do know of two cases, one involving a local anesthetic toxicity and another one involving an airway fire. If there's dispute on investigation whether the anesthesia provider, regardless of where they came from, has culpability in that, because there's different opinions on that. I'm sure my opinion is going to differ, but the anesthesia provider
had appropriate airway fire preparedness management for the type of dental case being performed, or if the anesthesia provider is charting every drug that goes into a patient because they are also their patient of record. If the dental board's investigation conflicts with an investigation, if there's even an investigation into place for someone that is not permitted. So that we have to kind of take with caution proceeding to make it only onto the facility and the attestation. How would you, if we come to those types of conflicts, how would you stop someone, a bad apple in one facility versus another going into another facility if they're not under the jurisdiction of the dental board? To some level of permit, which is the 1304, I believe, serves in that type of capacity as it exists.
So the individual in a case like that, if it's a non-dentist, goes before their respective board for the consequences of the event. So it should be investigated, you know, in that scenario where a dentist and a CRNA, that CRNA should be reported by the dental board to the nursing board if they weren't reported already, and then that individual will be investigated and disciplined appropriately by the nursing board. And if the result of that is a revocation of the license, they can't go anywhere else and do anesthesia, dental office, hospital, surgery center, anywhere. They'll have to follow the implications of the event.
Yeah, and that would align with just core ideas to be held accountable by those that understand your profession most and held accountable by one licensing board, not two. I mean, you're right. Could there be a bad actor that had a bad outcome last week who then travels to another place and has another bad outcome? Yes. The evidence so far hasn't been that we have anesthesia bad actors that are just out there sharing the pain with multiple places in a row, right? These adverse outcomes are disparate. You know, they're hard enough. But yes, the concern, but in the end, if they're meeting all the requirements of their board and we're meeting our requirements, we are making the right effort.
Yeah. This is Lasik, and this is just a point of clarification because I know it did come up previously about the, I guess the word I would use is the obligation to report, where currently our statutes are written that there is no onus on the dental board to report someone outside of dentistry, you know, for example, CRNA, MDA. Is that correct? And that would take a change in statute or no? Is that already the way it happens?
How about the staff? We'll let you. You're on the ground for it.
If something happens within the board, then we do report that to the appropriate board.
Okay. Sounds good.
Even if something's reported to our board that's not our jurisdiction of a licensee of another board, we pass it on.
Gotcha. So then the other point of clarification is I think we've really made some good headway here. Is it appropriate to present a motion about a statute change? And then someone else tried to help us write it, or how do we go from what we've created here, which I think is pretty good, to doing something and then having a vote on it or whatever? How does that happen?
Yeah, the doing something is a little hard because we're as a committee trying to make suggestions to then go to the board for the board to make suggestions. But yeah, if we're at a point that we can put it together in a list of this is what we're looking for, then yes, we could do a motion and go that direction.
Are we talking all levels of permits, 1301, 2, and 3?
I think this really applies to the 13, because to your question before, should it go to 1301, 2, and 3? Because there's a big difference in this part, because this is always bringing in an outside provider, right? So it really applies to the 1304.
Well, and right, I'm going to be off the zero for this, to Seth's point,
yeah.
Agenda item 1304, which is the primary discussion, is kind of leading over to some other things. But I would think Are we ready for a motion? I mean, I would think almost kind of like how we handle the
maybe we
adverse occurrences, like come back to meeting and come back.
Yeah, we write, you know, someone could own it, or we could, all of us could write our own version, and, you know.
All right, let's go on.
Yeah, you want to work together on language?
I'd love to farm it out.
All right, those words, let's go ahead.
We have a real consultant on the line as well. She's been helping the board.
With Jessica.
Her name is Jessica Ross. She is on the phone right now, so she has been helping the board out with changing of rules.
Yeah, and so that would help us to then have a motion that could work for the board, that the board could pass potentially, that could actually be put into a rule.
Exactly.
So, Jessica, are you on the line? Are we allowed? Am I allowed to call on her? Okay. Jessica, are you on the line?
I am. I'm here.
Have you heard enough of the words, thoughts, ideas, and concepts to prepare a draft that we could then review at the next committee meeting based on this discussion?
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but what I've heard in this discussion is to what extent the dental board wants to regulate CRNAs providing anesthesia services in a dental setting. Is that accurate?
No, not quite. It's more a discussion on 1304 and how to make it so that there is a way for the individual dental office to attest that they have the right equipment and credentialed individuals, whether they're CRNAs, dentists, physicians, oral surgeons.
But yeah. Dentists don't count for the 1304, correct? It's just a non-dental provider.
If they're a visiting provider, though.
Provider.
Part of the discussion was not having anesthesia being done in place that the dental board isn't aware of. Right. So it would be anybody that's not a 1301, 2, or 3 permit holder that wants that anesthesia in the office would have to.
Which by definition is a non-dental anesthesia provider?
No. So it would be like a
non-permanent dentist.
So if a dentist already has a permit to be a mobile provider, that doesn't apply.
If a dentist has a permit to administer sedation, they can bring in a dental anesthesiologist, an oral surgeon, a CRNA, or a physician without an additional permit. That's how it's described.
Yeah, so 4 doesn't matter.
Right.
Yeah.
It would be for the non-sedation permanent dentist that wants to do sedation, regardless of
1301 through 4.
Right. It doesn't matter. It would require any dentist that wants to work on a sedated patient to be permitted.
Or better said, if they don't have their own permit, this is what they need to do.
Exactly.
If you don't hold, yeah. That helps us because we had a lot of work.
1304 permit. Well, see, I think what we should do is I think at the next meeting when we're under the agenda item, current statute and the rules regarding the anesthesia and sedation, now that we've formulated an idea around a 1304 permit, we can bring that in there with updated.
Let's bring language that we can
discuss
the actual
specific. I think it's premature to start writing the rules.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I think it would be right. Could there be no need for a 1304 as it stands now?
This would be a replacement.
So they basically rewrite 1304. A lot of the requirements, right?
But. Yeah, and I think a significant portion of the conversation will revolve around what are those requirements going to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I agree.
Thank you. So would you be ready to move forward with language during the next committee meeting?
Maybe.
Okay.
Firm, possibly, we have no idea right now, but hopefully.
I think we would.
Yeah, we're gonna debate and discuss and hopefully decide on language that we would want turned into a rule.
Okay. So this is Hero. How do we want to proceed with preparing language for the next meeting? Or
I think we do the
discussion.
We do the same we did at the beginning, bring in the proposed language, and we can cover it.
I can work on some more.
So any and all members of the committee that want to say, hey, here's the version according to. Seth, it looks like you're wanting to make a comment for us.
I just got a question for staff. Have you obtained a exemption from the governor's executive order on rulemaking for this particular rule?
Hi, Seth. This is Christina. Actually, we are waiting from the governor's office right now. We're just waiting for their final opinion on that.
Okay, so without that, you probably shouldn't go much further than you already have.
Okay.
So, can you verify that? Or can you tell us what
this
that
is Christensen. We're not making rules here. We're making suggestions to the board.
Right, but without you, under the executive order, it's very dicey. You, to an extent, almost can't even do what you're doing without first getting approval to do it. So you, going further than you are right now could be a violation of the executive order.
So let's do this. Let's put this as a potential item on the next agenda based on the timing of that allowance to do it. And it looks like Jessica put her hand down, so I think she was going to make a comment along those lines. Dr. Brady, you still have your hand up. Is it tired, or is it you want to make a comment?
I was just to make a comment. This is Brady. I just wanted to say that I kind of understand a little bit coming midway through this. This is, we're talking about just things to help mitigate the CRNAs that want to go into an office, and this office doesn't have a permanent provider and being able to bring them in. Some kind of mechanism for them to write an attestation for that. And then I guess I'm under the understanding that there may be an executive order that we have to work around towards this with the governor. Is that correct? Am I in the correct ballpark?
Yeah, there's a moratorium on rulemaking without ability to, we have to get an exemption to that to make it so that the rule can be made.
This is Snell.
Okay.
Dr. Brady, I think it also, what it is implying is that it's not just the CRNAs or the MDXL, it's any dental office that doesn't have a sedation permit for that dental office, for them to allow or have sedation in their office by any provider, they need some type of paperwork filled out, certification, whatever you want to call it, to bring any sedation provider into their office.
This is Blazek, and I would agree with what Dr. Snell said, but I'd also expand on it that we are not requiring an inspection. This is our, I would say, meager attempt to ensure that the office is properly equipped to provide some level of anesthetic emergency service, and that the dentist that is there, as well as the staff, also has some basic understanding of, you know, the adverse occurrence type issue and how they would address it. That the onus doesn't fall entirely on the anesthesia provider that way.
Okay. There's a couple questions I guess I have for this. If you're a dentist, anesthesiologist, and oral surgeon, you're still going to have to apply and get the general anesthesia permit, your 1301 permit to be able to provide services. Then you're also going to have to go into a facility that has an additional 1304 permit. Is that a direction for this?
Yeah.
Not a permit.
Not a permit. Well, Dr. Brady, we're talking about turning that 1304 into a piece of paper.
An attestation or affidavit of some type.
Okay. Just to streamline that process.
Streamline the process, yeah.
And this is Harrow. Depending on staff turnaround, temporary privileges, so to speak, could be given immediately so that there's no hang up on offices that are currently bringing in outside anesthesia providers having to delay the continuity of their care.
Yeah, I think we're down the road as far as we should go today in 1304. So let's continue on, and hopefully we'll get the exemption timely enough that our next committee meeting we can do it.
I don't think we should have another committee meeting until we get this.
This might be for the staff. Is the exemption only, like, if we get the exemption for 1304, is it exclusive to 1304, or does it allow us to talk about any rules around dental anesthesia?
We are requesting an exemption for any rule regarding anesthesia.
Okay.
Jessica, did you have a comment for us?
Yeah, this is Jessica Thomas, if I may. I was actually looking at your exemption request. And specifically, it states that the board needs to amend its rules relating to anesthesia and sedation. The board intends to complete a rulemaking to amend its rules to allow for greater access to care by allowing non-dental professionals who are licensed to administer anesthesia and sedation to practice in dental settings, clarifying how such non-dental professionals may administer anesthesia and sedation in a dental practice will ensure such practices are safe, uniform, and consistent with standards of care within the dental industry. The board also intends to make other clarifying changes that are necessary to ensure the rules are clear, concise, and consistent. I would argue that the main focus of the request is, really the non-dental professionals administering sedation and anesthesia in the dental setting. But I think this last sentence would also give you some wiggle room to change rules that are also related to those anesthesia rules.
Can we make it more broad so we can discuss other things as well?
Yeah.
Or let's not meet.
It changed the.
Yeah, Jessica, maybe you have some understanding of the nuance. Can we revise our request, or does that put us back to the end of the line, or can we keep our spot in the line with the governor's office?
This is Jessica Thomas. To be perfectly honest, I've never done an amended request before. I don't know that there's necessarily a line. Each board typically has their own policy advisor that they're working with at the governor's office, and each policy advisor will handle requests, however they seem to do so. But I would say that if you're looking for something different but related, to just redo the request, I don't think it would cause too much delay. I know a lot of policy advisors are holding off on making decisions regarding requests that aren't super timely, just because they are focusing on legislative items right now. So
okay. Well, thank you, Jessica. So your advice is it's all going to wait till budget's done, and until the world stops till then. And so we could expand it. So to the question for the committee members, are we comfortable broadening it to the scope we thought we were meeting about?
The entire statute?
Yeah, we thought we were covering anesthesia.
Right, yeah.
And so thank you, Jessica, for reading the specifics. I think some of us were surprised to hear how specific some of it was. I don't think there was any intent by anyone, but we're... And knowing the nature of the board, we're going to make a recommendation as a committee, and the board's going to do whatever it wants. And so we need it to be able to be broad to get to an end line. So I don't know. Committee members, please go ahead.
I don't understand the executive order, so what I'm about to say is put that out there. But if the executive order is that rules are at a stopping point, but we formed this committee to try to help change what's in there. Why are we meeting if there's an executive order in place? Why don't we just wait until that's lifted?
Yeah, I think some of the intent was to get the exception. Jessica can give us a little more details on that. Please go ahead, Jessica.
This is Jessica Thomas. So first of all, I do not provide legal advice to the board, so I would always defer to your legal counsel. But I can provide a little bit of insight on how the executive order works and how the rulemaking process works within the, parameters of a moratorium. So one of the difficulties that everybody struggles with under the moratorium, which has been going on for quite some time under various governors, is that you're not supposed to be doing any formal or informal rulemaking without prior approval from the governor's office. The difficult thing is that when you make your request, it needs to be specific enough that the policy advisor at the governor's office knows what you're trying to do. I have seen requests be rejected because they're not specific enough. And so it's a fine line that agencies walk to disclose enough information so that they can get a request approved, but enough wiggle room that they can do everything that they need to do within that rulemaking as it relates to whatever subject matter they're looking to amend or create. So that's kind of the catch-22 in this whole situation is, first, you have to have some idea, at least to some specificity, of what you're wanting to do so that you can even make the request. Once you've made the request, you're not supposed to be doing any more work on that idea or those rules until you've received approval from the governor's office. So that's kind of the situation that the agency's in. I know that probably doesn't help a lot, but...
Well, Jessica, it helps, and before everybody walks out of the committee meeting right now, I thought we should ask Seth, since you hopefully can provide us legal advice, do we have anything broad enough there in the current request for an exemption that would allow us to go beyond just the CRNA issue? Does that end part give us the latitude to address other parts of anesthesia?
Yeah, without having everything in front of me to look at, I can't say for certain. My understanding is the committee was looking at the current statute and rules to make recommendations to the board whether or not they should pursue changing, not necessarily coming up with specific language. If the committee makes recommendations to the board pursue it, at that point they would request the appropriate exemption, and then once that's approved, then the committee can look at coming up with proposed language for the board to consider. That was my understanding.
And that would make
given the fact that there has not been an exemption approved yet, getting into specifics of what changes to make, I think goes beyond what is allowed. Now you're kind of doing informal, you're coming up with proposed language, but I believe reviewing the rules to determine whether something needs to be pursued for possible changes, I think that's acceptable to allow the board to request the exemption.
All right, thank you. What I understand, Goodman here, is that we are likely all in agreement that the board should pursue changes for what's happening for anesthesia. Is that an idea that everybody could get behind?
I second that.
Yeah. And based on what we've all gained additional learning today, it might be that we just need to give that opinion back to the board. And if they would like us to ask us to serve on a very similar committee to the one we're already on, the board could choose that. But I mean, I think most of us are kind of at the end of what we're able to do based on the parameters we've learned. Any thoughts, discussions?
I don't know that we need to make a firm decision on the recommendation of the board or involving this committee. I think we should just submit the exemption. It's already been submitted and not meet until we hear
a
response from it. Just pause until then.
But when we meet again, it would only be in reference to that one particular thing. We could go through and redefine moderate sedation.
Until we hear what the exemption is and then seek legal counsel at that point and kind of go from there. If the last part of the language gives us enough leeway to,
open it up.
To go back to the board can discuss and potentially make the correct.
I really need the moratorium on rulemaking.
It's kind of like we're trying to work with handcuffs on.
I'm happy to opine on the reasoning the governor may have outside of a recorded meeting. and there's many others that would be happy to. But it's not new to boards to have this. It's a little new to this committee and me for sure that we're in that specific narrow lane right now, but we appreciate the counsel and the advice. So let us pause the committee and pause where we are. I think we're in the right spot to
move to
adjourn today and bring the band back together when needed. All right. Is it all in favor?
I'm motion to adjourn.
Yeah, second. All in favor?
Sorry, this is Snell.
Goodman, second. All right. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
I feel remiss. I only got an hour and a half into this thing.
Where do I put it?